people's time. Great. So thanks, everyone. Hey, we'll start with introductions and welcome. So welcome. And my name is Manuel Vasquez. I'm the HIV Housing Programs Manager, but I'm Council Co-Chair for Council Affairs. Kat?
Hi, Kat Tochgear, Council staff. I will pass it over to TJ.
Hi, TJ Lee Miyake, Council Member and Council Affairs Member. So, pass it on to Chuck.
Chuck.
Okay, there we go. I was floating in and out of my home internet. There we go. I'm Chuck Adams, a member of Council Affairs and the council for a lot of years. And just moving on to Na.
Hi everyone, Nali, she, her, council member. I'll pass it to Reina.
I'm dead. Sorry. Reina, she, her pronouns, and I'm on the community engagement committee.
Great. Who is that?
Did Maria go yet?
No, Maria
Okay,
Lacayo.
yeah.
Hello, I'm Maria Lacayo. She, her, I'm with HIV Health Services, DPH.
Great. Who would you like to pass it to, Maria? Mara?
John
Okay.
Ainsley.
John.
Okay. Hello, hello, hello. Nice to see everybody. John Ainsley, HIV Health Services. I'm here twice, by the way. So my name on the computer here. I'm also the 415-279 number. So again,
Thank
nice to see
you.
everybody.
Awesome. And I don't know, John, if you can see anyone. Do you want to pass it? Or would you like me to
Yes,
pass
yes,
it?
yes. Let me see. Who hasn't gone yet? I can't quite
Mark,
see what you said.
Matt, Kira.
You said Mark first. We'll do Mark.
Okay.
Mark Molnar, Council staff.
Who would you like to pass it to, Mark?
Matt.
Matt Geltmaker, council member.
Great. Who would you like to pass it to, Matt?
Who's left? Kat? No,
Kira,
Kira.
Irma. Yeah.
All right, Kira, council staff, Irma.
Hi, Irma Parada, council co-chair.
And then last but not least, Paul Hepfer.
Hi, everybody. Paul Hepfer, CEO, Project Open Hand. Nice to see you all.
Great. Thank you, everyone. So we'll start next with review and approve the minutes. Is that right? Or the agenda? Okay. Thank you. Today's agenda. Okay. We will approve by consensus if no one has any comments. No comments?
I'm so
Yes.
sorry.
No worries.
I don't know how to do this.
Sure. If
I
you.
didn't read as many PMPs as I could. Policies and procedures, sorry. How can we add anything?
If you want to, so essentially this is just the agenda for today. If you have comments or questions about it or you want to add anything, you could say that for the record.
Okay, yeah, I just had a follow-up question, or I guess, yeah, from April
Okay.
on the ending the epidemic blueprint.
Okay. We'll probably do that
You
around
did.
announcements and public comment. We can take that question. Okay. Any other notes, comments? No? Great. Then we will pass by consensus. Okay. And now we will pull up the draft minutes from May 14th. Okay, everyone review. This is also in your email if you need to do that. I know it's kind of like, oh, scrolling through, but you can always check in your email too. Does anybody have any comments? No? Okay, if there's no comments, we will approve by consensus. Thank you. Okay. Now we'll go into announcements. So why don't we actually start with Raina? Why don't you take the floor for a moment with your question?
Okay, cool, thank you. My question was just if we had an update or a timeline around the equity or the metrics for accountability related to the blueprint. I know that DPH said that they were working on it back in April when it was brought up in both the full council meeting as well as this one. So yeah, if there were any updates or if we had a time.
I'm going to pass that to Maria. I know Bill's not on this call, but I think Bill was really working on that. Maria, do you have any updates or Mark?
I don't. Go ahead, Mark.
So my understanding of the motion, the motion went through a few different iterations, and my understanding of the motion is that basically what it did was to put on the annual work plan / presentation calendar an update from HHS on the blueprint. And so that's what will be happening. We received, obviously, that update where the motion was created by, I think, Derek Mapp. And so it will next appear next year on the work plan. That's okay. My understanding. Anyone, please feel free to add your thoughts on that. But that's my recollection of how that motion will be enacted.
So it sounds like it was accepted, Raina, and that they are working on it indeed. But it does look like it won't be made, I guess, spoken to, if you will, or given more updates until that time on the agenda that Mark mentioned.
That doesn't mean that during your Bill's regular monthly updates from HHS, that you, Raina, or anyone really, can't ask for like an update on the blueprint or anything else that HHS is working on. But as far as like a formal update per that motion, that will occur, again, per the motion annually.
Okay, yeah, that was my recommendation as well. I wasn't sure if that was just kind of the final. And then somebody else had a comment.
John? Yeah, John Ansley, did you have anything you want to add?
I was going to say, this is EHE related. What happens is we get our notice of award, which we just received about a couple of weeks ago, and then we submit a revised budget and work plan, which we just submitted. So when it comes to EHE related funding, we're a little bit of a holding pattern until we get full approval from HRSA.
Actually, thank you, John. I think what Raina may have been referring to was the blueprint that the state came up with, you know, for us to have all the different, I don't know how to call it, but basically it was like a 4-4 or something. So it includes ETE with CHEP, and it has activities that the state also is implementing. So I'll bring it back to Bill and let you know if there is anything. As far as I know, as right now, I haven't, I don't know if we've had a chance to really touch base on where it's at, because I don't really attend those meetings as much with that group that is heading that. So I'll bring it up to him and let you know if he can, you know, have an update at the next council meeting or at one of these committee meetings.
Great. And yeah, on that note, I would honestly recommend Raina bringing it up at the next general council meeting, and specifically whenever Bill provides that update, asking for it directly there.
Thank you. And I just last thing to add, and the reason why I brought it up was because I do recall that we'd mentioned both a qualitative and quantitative accountability metrics, and the motion that was passed only accounted for qualitative self-reported metrics or accountability reports. And so that's why I brought it up. So thank you. I will. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Awesome. Any other announcements before we move into public comment? No? Okay. Moving into public comment. Do we have any public comment here? No? Great. Okay. Well, now we're going to move into the meat of the meeting, our food presentation with Paul Hepfer.
It's funny how oftentimes people use food puns and they don't even know it. The meat of our presentation.
There we go.
Yeah. So is it my understanding is that you all want me to go through what I'm presenting? Is that right? Is that
yes. The
purpose of it? Okay. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, pretty much this is a preview of what's going to be done at the full council.
Okay.
We always get it first, and then we have comments and feedback, things like that.
Okay. Got it. Okay. So just my disclaimer is I do plan to have the slides a little prettier when I actually present them later. This is just kind of the bare bones. I have someone else that does that part for me because sure. I'm a Luddite that way. All right, let me share my screen. Hold on 1 second. Can you all see that?
Not yet.
No. Oh, okay. Hold on. Share screen.
If you need to, I think you can email it to Kira. Or Kira, do you have a copy of it?
I should be able to do this.
Okay, cool.
I'm just looking for the share button on. I've been on Teams all day. Where's the share?
It's usually at the bottom. Down the middle.
There it is, the green.
Okay.
How about that?
Yep, can y'all see that? We can see it. Yeah.
And let me hit start. Great. Okay. I wish I could see you all, but I can't. All I can see is my presentation. So I'll just go through and you'll just have to speak up if anyone has any questions or wants me to start or stop for any reason. Again, I'm Paul Hepfer, CEO of Project Open Hand. I know several of you, but if for those of you that don't know, I was on the HIV Planning Council in Santa Clara County for quite a few years and co-chair for a number of years. I've done my time and I know what the council and commissions are all about, and I'm happy to be a part of making this presentation for you all. I'm also a member of the California Food is Medicine Coalition. Project Open Hand's the lead agency for that organization. A member of the National Food is Medicine Coalition, and I'm a member of the National Evidence-Based Leadership Collaborative. Just wanted to give you a little background and context, and hopefully in this presentation you learned something about the food bank, home-delivered meal category, and Project Open Hand that you didn't already know, because I'm sure a lot of you already know quite a bit about us. But we began almost 40 years ago. In January, we will be celebrating our 40th anniversary. We began in 1985 with our founder, Ruth Brinker, serving meals made out of her own kitchen to individuals living with HIV and AIDS in San Francisco. And over the years, we've expanded into a number of areas, really because of the expertise we developed in the nutrition space in those early years. And most recently, on the right-hand side of this timeline, I'll be talking a little bit about this fully realized client-centered nutrition home model that we've been a part of developing. This timeline says in 2000, we expanded our services to include...
Paul, one moment. I'm not seeing the next slide. Has anyone else seen the next? Have you progressed yet?
I'm on the timeline. Do you all see the timeline?
No.
I think okay. It's in general view right now.
Okay. How about now?
Yes, we can see the timeline now.
I'm going to do it in this rather than presentation mode because because I can see you all too.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you stopped me because this is a nice timeline that I wanted to share. So again, like I mentioned, in 2000 is when we expanded our services to include people with other chronic health conditions, which includes heart disease, diabetes. Cancer was one of the first ones that we added after HIV. We actually had a project with Susan Coleman Breast Cancer Foundation, and that led to several other health conditions. And really, it was largely at the request of the community and healthcare providers because it was well recognized that our nutrition was different than a lot of community-based food. It was healthier. We were able to get it to people. We were able to provide a number of really warm type services. And so we were asked to do this. My understanding is back in 2000, there was some controversy around, way before I was here, controversy around Project Open Hand expanding services to other health conditions, that there was a fear that we would stop serving people with HIV. And that hasn't happened. I understand why the fear was there, but it's been many years since, and you'll see that that we have not lost our guiding star and serving the population we were formed to serve. Any questions on kind of our past history? Nope. Okay. Next, little background on the range of health conditions and the demographics that we provide for folks. You'll still see in the bottom circle there, the diagnosis, about 26% of our clients that we serve throughout the Bay Area have HIV and AIDS. Heart disease is growing up around 9%. Diabetes is 29%. And this isn't broken down by many, many people have multiple chronic health conditions, and that's something I'm going to talk here in a little bit about. And that's the trend we're seeing nationally, and it plays out here in the Bay Area. 42% of our population is over 60, and this is similar to what Bill Bloom provided in his presentation last month. I think many of you saw the age trend of people living with HIV and AIDS, and then ethnic racial demographic is provided there on the left-hand side. We have volunteers is still a really important part of what we do, with last year being over 30,000 hours, over $1 million worth of volunteer service time, and 89% of volunteers are reoccurring. They come in on some sort of regular basis. Okay. And then I thought it was important to provide a little context of the external scope of what we do. We have a number of state and federal healthcare policy folks we work with. Within the demographics of what we serve, you saw on the last slide, a number of chronic health conditions, a much more aging population. We really attempt to respond to the consumer's needs and preferences. And we've also seen that social isolation and loneliness is an ever-increasing issue that all of our clients are dealing with. This was really shown even greater during the most recent COVID pandemic. It's actually something that we are getting responses from other healthcare providers to ask if there's ways we can partner with them to address loneliness and social isolation. It's interesting that I think we are probably the only nonprofit sector that actually has to deal with competition. In most of our nonprofit worlds, no one wants to do what we do because it's really hard and no one else sees any dollar signs in it. But in the food space, interestingly enough, because there is now a billable revenue source for some populations, we are actually seeing competition from the for-profit sector come in this space and undercutting us in our prices. And healthcare companies like Kaiser, for one, contracting with a large national food provider that produces their food in Iowa, and they ship them all over the country. We're a little worried about how that's going to look for the rest of the nonprofit food providers if this trend continues. It's a lower quality meal. It's not medically tailored. It's not organic. It's not locally produced. It's not locally delivered. But it's a reality that I'm finding myself for the first time having to deal with the for-profit space. I'm going to talk a little bit about nutrition insecurity here in a little bit. And then the last driver is that everything we do at Project Open Hand is evidence-based. It's not just a nice thing to do anymore. We really rely on science, and the science drives how we deliver service, what type of food we provide, what type of ingredients we use, and how we focus our priorities. So we'll talk some about that too. Any questions before I move on? Okay. Next slide. And then I thought it was important for the council to know that we serve a number of roles in the state of California, Project Open Hand, and national, and that we do policy work, we do advocacy, we have a lobbyist in Sacramento that works with our whole California coalition of medically tailored meal providers. We provide the backbone for a number of larger initiatives particularly with the Department of Healthcare Services, where they contract with us, and then we subcontract to partners around the state to do medically tailored meals in instances where smaller nonprofits aren't able to do the medical billing or have the HIPAA security or the infrastructure in place to do that. We work with a lot of folks on UCSF, Stanford, Berkeley, Tufts University, on research and evaluation related to nutrition. A study was just published by UCSF that we did with them in 2018 related to HIV and nutrition and diabetes. And then we've also published several research studies related to medication adherence and nutrition in HIV. And we're really interested in doing really high quality research, because that helps us improve our services, but it also helps to advocate for funding for this type of service that we provide. And we're a healthcare partner. We no longer just view ourselves as a food security provider. We are a healthcare organization. We have to meet many of the same standards as many hospitals and clinics when it comes to billing and IT infrastructure. Everyone you see here are partners that we have contracts with to provide different types of service. Now, for a little context setting, I think everyone on the council has heard of food insecurity. Food insecurity is the limited or uncertain availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods, or limited or uncertain ability to acquire acceptable foods in socially acceptable ways. So that's food insecurity. We heard a lot about that during COVID. I'm sure all of you heard about that. There were some national reports on putting a spotlight on the scope of food insecurity that many people didn't know existed. San Francisco was no stranger to that either. And there were a number of studies done by the public health department that showed how many people were experiencing food insecurity during the COVID pandemic. What we like to talk about is nutrition security, though, because it's a little bit different. It's more than a subtle difference, but it's a really important difference. Nutrition security means consistent access, availability, affordability of foods and beverages that promote well-being, prevent disease, and if needed, treat disease. So this is really different than just making sure people have something to eat. This is making sure people have the right foods for their health to prevent disease and to help people be healthier. A good way to illustrate this is what we call the spectrum of food of nutrition, the spectrum of nutrition and the food as medicine movement. So with this continuum here, if you look at the bottom of the triangle, population level healthy food policies and programs, you've all heard of school lunch program, right? That would be one of these programs. There are Head Start programs that have population level food lunch, summer lunch program is one. Then you move up a little bit, and then there's more specialization that happens there, and the population is more specialized. Nutrition security programs like SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, WIC, you've all heard of WIC, and maybe different, more refined school lunch types of programs. Then as you look on the left-hand side of the triangle, we're going from prevention to treatment the further up the triangle we go, into produce prescription programs, which are programs that hospitals and clinics do, where a medical provider might actually write a prescription encouraging someone to consume more produce. These have been around for a while. They're really effective, and they've really gained a lot of exposure in the last couple of years. And then even more specialized are what we call medically tailored groceries. These, we, Project Open Hand, and all of our partners throughout the state provide medically, or many of our partners provide medically tailored groceries that will include items that are tailored towards your specific health condition. And then the most specialized are the medically tailored meals. And when we talk about medically tailored meals, we also have to talk about nutrition counseling from a registered dietitian that accompanies those medically tailored meals. We have 12 different meals that we provide for a number of different health conditions, from heart disease, cancer, a bland diet. I know that sounds really appealing, doesn't it? A CKD meal for people with chronic kidney disease and people that are on dialysis. So those are the most specialized. And when I say we, I'm talking about our partners in the National Food as Medicine Coalition and the California Group. Those being a part of that coalition has led to a lot of research focused on diabetes management, improved mental health, medication adherence. We were a part of some of that many years ago, healthier eating habits. And all of this research has been a really important part of securing long-term funding for medically tailored meals. Research has shown that these types of services reduce hospitalization. And I'm not, you know, some of you might be familiar that if a hospital releases someone, let's say with heart disease, and they're readmitted within 30 days, that hospital does not get reimbursed for that, the stay that that person was in the hospital. And that could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. So healthcare payers are really interested in ways to reduce readmissions. Medically tailored meals have been shown to reduce readmissions. We're not doing it just because of that cost savings, but it's an important part of what we do. And then to give you a little bit of snapshot of how our intervention really works, it is a unique approach. We have a referral from a medical provider that could be a physician, a social worker, a nurse practitioner, and another partner provider. We do an intake. We assess we look at eligibility and make sure that everyone is eligible for, or what service they are eligible for based on their payer. Could be Ryan White, could be Medi-Cal, could be Medicare, could be another health insurance plan. Then we do a nutrition risk assessment. And then we have a registered dietitian working with this person, all the while that we're working on getting the person the service starts and the meal is delivered within a certain period of time. And we are able to help the person that was referred make sure they have the right type of meal with us and medically tailored groceries if they want them or if they're eligible for them. So that's kind of the scope of what we've been doing over the last several years. And then I want to jump into some of the emerging trends and issues, challenges, and opportunities that we have in this space. Everyone good with that so far? Any questions?
Nope. No.
Okay. A week ago, I think it was a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, we celebrated Long-Term Survivor Day. We know that because people are living longer with HIV, that we now have the opportunity to research and evaluate the types of services and really look at how can we shape our interventions and offerings to help people live longer and healthier lives. I just thought, I was just curious about, it was about 7 years ago, we were just starting to talk about the need for more research, and there really wasn't much research out there 7-8 years ago. And a quick scan shows that there are a number of bodies, academic institutions, healthcare institutions that are actually looking at this now. But research takes time, and it's really been slow to come out to a point that I think has been helpful for a service provider. And what I'm looking for is research that would help shape what we are doing. How can we adapt our services or our products to meet the needs that are identified through the research? One such research study that I think was really important came out recently, 2022, and I'll have the link here for anyone that wants to look at this. But this study really looks at some of the secondary chronic health conditions that people are living with HIV are experiencing. Almost all the health conditions identified in this study, chronic kidney disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, chronic inflammation, hypertension, these are all health conditions that are particularly respond to a nutrition intervention, or the converse to that too. Meaning, if you eat a lot of high sodium, high fatty foods and you have heart disease, you will negatively, your body will negatively respond to that type of nutrition. If you consume medically tailored meals that are designed for someone with congestive heart failure, diabetes, hypertension, chronic kidney disease, you can experience positive effects of those nutrition interventions. So for us, it's important to realize that, and we're seeing this in the data that Bill shared last month too, the number of people living with secondary chronic health conditions, 3 or 4 or even 5, on addition to HIV, even make the need for a medical intervention, a food as medicine approach, even more important for people living with HIV than I think it ever has been. I think in the early days, we were focused on wasting disease and calories and nausea and some of those things. And nutrition was probably one of the most, probably the second most important intervention. But over the years, you know, people start to say, well, you know, maybe nutrition isn't as such a big deal for me anymore because I am more independent. I have an undetectable viral load. I have these other things. But where we're seeing the need is really with these secondary chronic health conditions. And that's where, you know, when I talk to providers, people are having a hard time dealing with their heart disease or diabetes than they are maintaining their HIV. Some of the types of these food as medicine, I spelled it out, but I will throw these acronyms around all the time. Food as medicine interventions kind of look two different ways. We have people referred to us for a short-term intervention. When I say short-term, it's generally about 12 weeks, maybe 24 weeks if the provider extends it. This often happens when someone has uncontrolled diabetes. They were just discharged from a hospital. They've had excessive weight gain or excessive weight loss, and they need a nutrition intervention, or they've had oral health issues like removed several teeth, and they can't eat, but they can't chew, so they would need a mechanical soft diet or something else that's that might be short term that we're able to provide. Then we have people that are on extended nutrition interventions, multi-year. Most of our Ryan White clients are on our service for an extended period of time, many years. In some cases, we have people that have received our services for 20 years. And you know, I think many people that when the short-term intervention is suggested by a provider, what we tell them is that, you know, some of the issues aren't going away in 12 weeks. And really, you ought to consider a longer-term intervention for someone that might need it. If someone has the inability to access proper nutrition because of economic needs, or cognitively they can't figure out how to access what's most important to their health condition, that situation's not going to be resolved in 12 weeks, and therefore a longer intervention is needed. And then what I'm focused on at Project Open Hand, kind of the future of the food as medicine in the Bay Area. We have some challenges and some opportunities. Some of the challenges are, and this is a real thing, I know some of you probably know people that receive our services, and you've heard this. It's a term we call POH, food fatigue. If you've been receiving our food for a long, long time, some people are just tired of it. Even if they get just one meal a day, there's a period of time where, you know, I just want something different. And so we try and address that by making sure that at least our groceries have some variety in them. And our food does have a lot of variety. We have 500-600 meals we provide. So, and they rotate through every 6 months. But still, after 10, 20 years, there's some fatigue that's going to set in there. For us, from a operations perspective, the inflation that we were hit with 15-20% raw food cost over the last few years has really hurt us. And then labor cost in the Bay Area to produce a million meals a year out of our 730 Polk Street kitchen has been a challenge. And then we also, occasionally we will have to deal with misinformation from providers about, oh, don't worry about carbs or fats, or, you know, the fuzzy science associated with nutrition. Even medical providers are not always the best at adhering to a science-based approach to diet. And that is a challenge for us to deal with that. And then it is challenging to maintain the highest level of quality when it's cheaper to do it other ways. Our partner, the competitor I mentioned to you, in the Midwest and Nebraska or Iowa, wherever that is, they have preservative in their meals. They have higher levels of sugar. They have higher levels of sodium. They have a lot of things that make it cheaper and easier for them to provide a meal, but doesn't make it healthier. And so those are challenges that we're constantly faced with. And then some of the opportunities that we have over the next few years, we have been working on the challenge of providing more culturally relevant nutrition products and services. We're looking at a concept where we can do component meals. You know, we do 2,500 to 3,000 meals a day. We can't have five different culturally relevant nutrition lines. It's just impossible for us. We'd be out of business next week. But we are looking at ways that we can provide components of meals or different sauces to be more that might break up the monotony of the meal and also might be more culturally relevant to them too. So we actually have a manager that we have looking at nutrition innovation and actually investing in that to figure out how we can continually innovate for the purpose of people wanting to eat what we serve, because if people don't want to eat what we're providing, it's not going to help their health at all. And related to that is marketing, doing better marketing around the intent of our food as medicine services. We're not here just to put some food in someone's belly. We're really here to help people be healthier and manage their health condition. And we don't always do a great job marketing the intent of our service. We have an interesting model we're working on. We're calling it the client-centered nutrition home, and it's based off of the model of the patient-centered medical home, which is an evidence-based approach to practice. And so we're looking at if we design services around the elements of the patient-centered medical home, but specific to nutrition, could that result in a healthier client that we're working with, and hopefully delay or even prevent secondary chronic health conditions that someone with HIV might be facing in the years to come. This is really exciting. This is an exciting model that we've been working on for a couple of years that is really pretty unique to Project Open Hand, and several of our national partners are looking at how they could model something around this. And then with that, happy Pride. I wanted to let you all know, in case you didn't hear this, Project Open Hand was voted the best LGBTQ nonprofit in the Bay Area Reporter this year by Bay Area readers. We're really happy with our 40-year history and happy to hope that we're around for another 40 years. Question? Feedback?
Thank you, Paul. Have any questions or feedback from anyone? Lots of hands clapping. That's great.
Thank you, Raina. Thank you so much for that presentation. Y'all are an absolute godsend for a lot of folks in the Bay. Both, we know that folks living with HIV are very much impacted by food insecurity, and it also impacts HIV prevention efforts or negative folks who are vulnerable to HIV. I wanted to ask, so thank you so much. And your staff is very sweet. I wanted to ask if you all have like a provider on your staff, and or what your operations have looked like in terms of taking advantage of recent Medicaid updates in terms of billing and screening for social determinants of health. Is that something I'm sure you
Yeah, great question. Actually, the biggest opportunity that's come our way, and this is the result of policy work we've been working on for even before I was here. When I was in the South Bay, I was working with the former staff here, Mark Ryle. Some of our services, the meals and the RD counseling, is now a billable service. If you have a certain health condition in a certain situation, your physician or provider can refer you to the health plan, and we can get you on service. And we have contracts with Alameda Health Alliance and San Francisco Health Plan. So we can bill for that service for some people, but it's short term. We haven't had anyone. I'm not sure if we have. Most of the referrals coming in are diabetes and heart disease related. We actually are serving some people with high risk pregnancies now. If you have gestational diabetes, you're eligible for our type of nutrition, which is really exciting because now we have the possibility of impacting two generations, not just the person receiving the meals. That's probably the most exciting development in the last 10 years of our service. Rena, you asked about a provider. We have 8 registered dietitians on staff now with us. And we work really closely with a number of clinics that actually make the referral to the health plan that then comes to us.
And is that both on the HIV prevention and care area or?
Yeah, we work really, we get direct referrals from HIV providers. We do not get direct referrals for the people on the Medicaid, like the diabetes and heart disease. That has to come from the health insurance company. But we do get direct referrals. And we are looking at ways with the social determinant screening. I think there's an opportunity for us to, as a service provider, do some of that under contract from the managed care organization. We're looking at, could we do that? Could we do wellness checks and actually bill the health plan for the wellness checks that we're kind of already doing anyway, to help offset some of the unfunded pieces of what we do.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Mark, your hand's raised.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for the presentation. Hey, I really liked how extensive it was. I think a couple things to keep in mind is that we don't usually have service providers come to speak so specifically about their agencies or about the funding challenges that their agencies might be having or about other non-Ryan White clients the agency might be serving. I think that's all very interesting for sure. Certainly as a person who cares for an elder, it's very interesting for me on a personal level. But because the idea of an individual agency being able to sort of advocate for like themselves rather than for a service category is sort of a real issue for HRSA and for, you know, I mean, you were on a planning council, so you know this as well as I do. We kind of try to caution against that, and we hope that providers will shy away from that. It's great to talk about how great your services are, for sure. And we should also know like what you should be doing. But I would hit a little bit more lightly things like slide 6 or other places where you're talking about non-Ryan White level services, if that makes sense. Like, I don't want to take away from a lot of the really great things in this presentation, particularly around things like food insecurity, which is something that the council should know about. But things that are really kind of extolling the agency, Project Open Hand, could be seen as like, oh, okay, wow, this person is just really wanting to make sure that they get funded, which is fine, but that's more of a public comment type thing than a presentation to the council, which is often more centered around what does the service category do? Why is it necessary? Why the struggle is real? Uh-huh. And what do Ryan White clients need from this service category?
So, and I think your presentation, so maybe take 5 and 6, take those two out.
That's what I would recommend. For sure. Just so that you are, I mean, you're not unbiased. Obviously, you're the head of an excellent agency, but you want to, in some ways, like speak to the service category on a whole while also speaking about your agency that you're proud of. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. I'll take 5 and 6 out. Anything else that, I mean, I think the coalition stuff was important though, right? The spectrum.
I think that's important too. Well, I did like how you talked about there are other sort of systemic things happening and there's coalitions that are addressing the systemic things. That's actually important for the council to know. That might not always be Ryan White, but we are also interested in other funding streams and certainly coalition building across different entities. So I think those stay in.
Okay, great.
No, your hand's raised.
Yeah, I had a couple questions. So I work in Marin County, so maybe it's because I'm not as familiar, but what are the, so for the referrals, is it only providers, like medical providers, or can like case managers refer their clients?
They can.
Yeah. Okay.
They sure can.
And then in terms of who's eligible, is it a lower income eligibility requirement or is it just the 500% FPL for Ryan White?
For Ryan White, it's all Ryan White, whatever the county eligibility is.
Okay, great. And I'm curious if your agency is interested in expanding beyond San Francisco and Oakland.
So are you, you said you're in Marin. Do you work with Food for Thought? Are you familiar with them?
No.
They serve Ryan White clients in Marin, and they buy their meals from us.
Okay. That's good to know. I actually didn't know this.
And they have a food bank. We do serve, we started serving Contra Costa County during the pandemic. We have been asked to serve Sacramento County, and that's really tough so far. We can ship frozen 7-packs now, and we did a lot of that during the pandemic. And so the reason we would be interested in serving other areas is if it makes the whole coalition more viable. I did a interesting pilot with with the State Office of AIDS about 8 years ago, where my previous agency did nutrition case management for Humboldt County Department of Public Health, Ryan White clients, and San Joaquin. And our registered dietitian in San Jose, actually using the phone, was able to arrange nutrition shipments to HIV Ryan White clients in Humboldt County. And it was a really successful, and she used for profit, like HelloFresh, Freshly, Blue Apron, Factor, before Factor was here. And it was a really successful pilot that was a way to reach rural areas where you're not going to have a kitchen like ours that does a million meals a year. So we would expand in areas where there is no other ability for us to do that, in hopes of, you know, reaching people that don't have another means of getting this type of nutrition.
Thanks. One more question. So it's very specific. On the slide where you showed the breakdown of folks that you serve and their conditions, it adds up to 100. So if someone has HIV and diabetes, which would they fall under?
I'd have to ask. I think it might. I don't think we list the secondary health condition for someone with HIV on this slide, because a lot of times we don't know.
Okay.
We wish
so,
we knew.
So it's only the whatever they listed as their primary condition. Diagnosis. So it could have been HIV. It could have been diabetes, depending on what they put. Okay.
Yeah, we'd like to be able to drill down deeper in that, because that's what, you know, a lot of the national research that wants to be able to track what percent of people with HIV have three or more chronic health conditions. We don't necessarily know that unless we can get the information. We will be able to, with the data exchanges soon, be able to get more information, because we're participating in those.
Great, thanks.
Great. Mark, your hand's raised again.
Sorry, I forgot to mention, I only went to the constructive. I forgot to mention the particularly the positive part. You know, I think it's important that you hit, I guess, as hard as you hit here in this presentation, the idea of nutrition and how that's being tracked. One thing that often gets overlooked as far as the food service category goes is the idea that it not just funds free meals, which of course is the main event, but also the idea of nutrition planning. It also, you know, can, like Ryan White can fund a nutritionist. I think the project manager had one before. Oh, you still, okay. So I think it's important to definitely underline that. And I like seeing that in your presentation, because it's often just sort of forgotten as far as it being a key part of the delivery of food services.
Yeah. So thank you for that. Make sure I highlight that. Yeah. We have all of our clients, no matter what your health condition, is eligible to work with a registered dietitian at least on a monthly basis, if not more, which is a pretty great service to be able to offer people.
Okay. Thank you so much, Paul. Great. Any other questions before we move on? No? Great. Okay. Next on the agenda is CQI Quality Assurance presentation with John Ainsley.
Hello, yes. I know we're coming up against time here, so I don't think this will take too long, given that this is pretty much the same presentation.
We actually have over an hour. Yeah, we actually are scheduled to so go on.
I thought we were only until 4 o'clock. Okay. Can you all see my screen okay?
Yes.
And how's that? That look okay?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. So, John Ainsley, HIV Health Services. This is a presentation we give every year. Years ago, it was Celinda Cantu who did this, and I took it over some time ago. And yeah, you're used to seeing this every year. And it's not complete, unfortunately. I'm still working on it. There are a few things that I thought were a bit too wordy, a bit too convoluted. So I'm trying to clean up a little bit, but we'll definitely have it ready by the time we have the full council in a couple of weeks. So title slide. And then we have table of contents. First section is going to be the purpose, goals, activities of our CQI and CQM. CQI being continuous quality improvement, CQM being continuous quality management. Next section is going to be considerations and measures, basically giving you some context around the data and some of the limitations that we have. Section three is the bulk of it. That's the data overview and the analysis of the data. And then the last slide is going to be questions and comments, everyone. So, yeah. So this is a slide I'm still working on. This is the purposes of CQI. Again, I thought it was a little bit too wordy, so I'm trying to clean it up. But the general idea is to assess, plan, and improve HIV services in San Francisco. And then our goals, which is to analyze key HRSA quality indicators, utilize data to improve health outcomes, report out to federal, state, and planning bodies like yourself. And it's used for individual program performance evaluation. So this is part of how we evaluate programs during annual site visits by the business office. So we are currently still using Epic, and we are currently still using Aries. We continue to use Epic, but we are moving from Aries to HIV Care Connect. I'm not sure when that's going to happen. Maria might have a better idea about that. I've heard possibly the next 3 to 4 months, but you know, that could be 6 months, could be the end of the year. Really not sure. But Epic is absolutely a foundational piece how we do data. It's where all of our medical data goes into, and HIV Care Connect is hopefully how we're going to get it out when it comes to tracking things like retention and care, ART prescription, and viral suppression.
John, I would just say that I don't know anything else about HCC, just so everybody knows just what John said, but Epic is used mainly for our DPH-funded programs.
Yeah, yes. Thank you, Maria. So the activities, we're always doing data collection improvements. We have two people we're currently working with now. We brought on a couple of months ago. We're doing a ton of data entry into Aries to help clean up data so we can track some of these indicators properly. Our goal is to improve viral suppression in all of our clients. But since 2020, we've had two focuses. One was increasing viral suppression in the Black and African American communities. And then since 2022, we've moved on to also increasing viral suppression in those persons who are experiencing homelessness and or unstable housing. We also do a number of trainings on a variety of topics. I used to organize those with Kevin Hutchcroft, who many of you might remember. We've since shifted it over to Maria and Nina, who are organizing that. We do a bunch of things, like we used to do updates on the care continuum, updates on medical innovations. We do things like, Maria, what have we done the last year? You know, like...
We actually have been providing different trainings with AHP as a partner, and they have done, you know, transgender services. We also had a training on Latinx service providers and how to best serve that population with a trainer that was not affiliated with the HP. So there's been a variety, motivational interviewing, and what was the home
trauma informed care?
Harm reduction is. They just did that about a week ago or two.
And these trainings are also open up to the planning council as well. So if any of you all want to attend, you are by more means welcome. So some considerations and measures. We ideally track three measures: retention and care, ART prescription, and viral suppression. Now, retention and care has been incredibly difficult to track in Aries. Getting that data out of Aries has been a real challenge. So I'm not reporting on that. ART prescription also is pretty imperfect in Aries. Once ART goes in, it kind of just sits there and it's not updated. So what I did for this presentation is I reported out on viral suppression, the percentage of clients with a viral load below 200. I think it paints the best picture. If you want me to pull retention as imperfect as it is and ART, I can. One thing I did in the past was use a viral load screening as a proxy for retention. It's really not that perfect. Also, the HRSA measure is a little bit out of date in that the HRSA measure is still a visit in the first 6 months of the year and a visit in the second 6 months of the year. But for a client who's been with Ryan White Services for upwards of, you know, even 10, 15 years now, and they've been virally suppressed for those 10 or 15 years, they really need to come in twice a year. They're looking at shifting this at some point in the future, but yeah, the retention measure is a little imperfect. So for the purposes of this presentation, I reported out on viral suppression.
John, one person has their hand raised. Matt?
Just real quick.
So yeah, any help there?
Yeah. So John, I'm assuming you only pulled this out of Aries for San Francisco, or did you pull this for the entire EMA?
Yes, just for San Francisco, not for Marin and San Mateo.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
So data overview is all from the Aries database. I pulled data last week. It's annual, so January through December. And the presentation is designed to address CQI thresholds and not to compare models of care. And here's our first data slide, which is viral suppression by gender identity. And you can see all have improved substantially from 2010 when we first rolled out Aries to 2023. I think I can't see the corner there, but for trans women, we're 73%, so I think to 88%. And something I try and do for these presentations is pull something that I think is interesting or sticks out, something that I think will grab the people who are consuming this data into something that might be interesting. I also will say that I do not interpret this data, I just share it. So when it comes to questions about what this means, that might be better for someone who has more of a research background. So I just pull the data and share it. But when it comes to interpretation, I do take more of a hands-off approach there. So again, something I found interesting, I pulled the number of UDC for cis men, cis women, and trans women. And you can see cis men for our HHS-provided services went down 31% in the last 13 years. Cis women down 28%, but trans women went up 14%. So again, something I thought you might find somewhat interesting. Next slide is viral suppression by housing status. No surprise here that individuals with unstable housing do have lower viral suppression rates, but they all have improved substantially in the last 13 years. Again, something I thought you might find interesting is unstable housing by gender identity. And you can see consistently over the past 13 years, trans women routinely have higher rates of unstable housing. Within 2018, 40% of trans women in our system of care had unstable housing. It's something of note that I think is important. Next is age range by decades. So 0 to 29, 30 to 39, 40 to 49, 50 to 59, 60 to 69, and 70 plus viral suppression. Now, I do think these slides do get a little bit busy with all the lines, so I did pare it down the next one. So now you have 0 to 39, 40 to 59, 60 to 69, and 70 plus. It just looks a little bit cleaner, but you have both, so you can get the worst from both of them. The older the client population, the more likely they are to be virally suppressed. And again, something I found interesting is the number of patients who are over 60. And again, you kind of have the busy slide here. The next one, I clean it up. And so you can see back in 2010, 10% of the patients, our clients, were over 60 years old. Now it's almost 40%. And if this trend continues, By the time 2030 rolls around, it will be about 60%. Race, ethnicity, viral suppression again. Now, something that changed this year is in years prior, we used to include Native American, Native Alaskan, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander. And I kind of lumped them all under other here for a couple of reasons. One, the slide gets very busy. Two, the number of clients is so low. You do risk outing people's individual viral suppression when you're talking about 3, 4, 5 clients. So I put them under other. Now I have the data. If you want me to put them back in rather than just having these 5 categories, that's totally fine. It's simple enough to do. It'll take me 2 minutes. But I thought it'd be best to have the 4 major ones and then other, keep it nice and clean. And then as an emphasis slide, emphasize Black and African American, given that was a point of emphasis for our CQI efforts back starting in 2020. So we were at 67%, and I can't quite see it, but I do believe it's at 86% now. And that difference is no longer statistically significant. Next slide, I did viral suppression by funding source. Again, something I thought was interesting. No surprise that EHE is the lowest, given that they do prioritize patient populations that are out of care and have the largest issues when it comes to engaging with care. And that's where we're at. So I'm open to all ears and all ideas and everything. So yeah, any thoughts? And please let me know.
Thank you, John.
And if someone could lead the question, that appreciate it, since I can't see the hands.
Sure. There's no one's hand raised right now. Does anybody have any questions?
Or any ideas?
Or any suggestions or ideas? No. Not seeing any. Mark shaking his head, who usually has something. Okay, great.
Hey, John. Sorry, John. Matt? Just confirming. So that's the HIV HAB QM measure report in ARIES that you do?
Using a STAR report.
Okay, gotcha. Have you? Yeah. So, yeah, because I remember we used to use that HAB QM measure report, and it's an awkward one to run, and we ran into a lot of problems in it with it in the past. So, okay.
Same, yeah. Now, the STAR report is imperfect.
Yeah.
But I guess the best way I can explain it is pulling the data going back 13 years. It's perfectly imperfect in a way.
Yeah, know? Yeah. It's consistently imperfect. Yeah.
Well, although I should add, this is Maria, that we do have 2 data entry specialists that we've been able to hire this year. And they have been working on updating a lot of the viral load data in ARIES. So we're hoping that we'll take care of, you know, anybody who has like a really old viral load, like what we were referring to is that STAR report. If someone had a really old viral load, it would keep reporting it as if they just had it recently, right? Like that was a recent viral load, but we've been cleaning that up. And we do have a worksheet that did take over that HAPQM report, Matt, that we use, that actually I just realized I don't think you guys ever had taken a look at, but if you're interested, let me know. That is
what we send me something. I know God only knows how long ARIES is going to be around, but right. I mean, I'm still uploading every Monday all the clinical data. I load, you know, CD4 viral load, GCCT, syphilis, QFTs, you name it, HCV screen, everything gets uploaded. And it's hard to pull it out of ARIES with that HEBQM data report. Only will pull if a viral load, I believe is where the problem I was having, it only pulls the viral load data if they had a Ryan White funded outpatient ambulatory service. Mm-hmm. And that excludes the vast majority of our patients. So we get this really low N.
Oh, no. I'll share that with you.
Yeah. So anything that kind of gives us better, because what we have to do then is we just have to run spreadsheets and kind of pivot tables and things to get the accurate data. And it, yeah. So thank you.
Maria, are you cleaning it up for the EMA or for SF?
For SF. Yeah, we don't have access to your data. Yeah, so it's only, and I should be specific that it's for our DPH-funded medical providers.
Yeah.
Great.
I know that our viral load data is accurate in Aries. It's just getting the report out. That's the problem. It's like,
we understand. We had that worksheet we created with Dave Rank, and I'll share it with you. That might help.
Great. TJ, your hand's raised.
Thanks, Manuel. Hey, I was just curious. I thought HIV Care Connect replaced Aries in May as the new system. And when is that? It's not? It hasn't replaced it?
There was a bump in the road.
It's on hold.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Bump is put in my
tree. Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much again, John. Any other questions? That is our last item on the agenda before we adjourn. Or actually next meeting.
You know, if anybody has any thoughts that comes to them while they're, having dinner tonight or whatever, feel free to shoot me an email. That's totally fine too.
Sure. Thank you so much, John. Our next meeting date and agenda items. So the next Council Affairs Committee is scheduled for July 9th from 3 to 4. That's our usual, but just so everyone knows, we do have 2 hours blocked in the invite. So if we run over. Okay. Any other things anyone wants to share before we adjourn? No? Great. Well, thanks, everyone. Have a great week. We adjourn.
Bye.